This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 150 was recorded early this week on Tuesday, January 15th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Nomura's Charlie McElligott was the man who called the Christmas equity massacre before it happened, and he's become one of our favorite macro strategists on the program. Charlie will join me this week as our featured interview guest, and we'll be discussing the equity market recovery and how long Charlie thinks it will last, bond yields, gold, and much more. Now, normally, we tell you at this point what to expect from our post-game segment after the feature interview, and I've got a real treat for you this week. Charlie gave us such a fantastic interview that when we finally started to bump up against our time limit, I just threw the timer out the window. We let Charlie run long, over an hour, but I think you're really going to find this one worth your time. In fact, it may be one of our best interviews yet. So we'll have a very abbreviated post-game segment this week, and we'll be back to our regular format after we return from Macro Voices Live in Vancouver. And yes, there's still time to sign up to join us in Vancouver at macrovoices.com/live.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's start with the S&P 500 because we continue to see the S&P hovering at this 2600 level, continuing to push a little bit higher. What's your take on what's going on in the S&P 500?
Well, not a whole lot of change since last week, although the market has continued to do exactly what I thought it was going to do. Again, I am persuaded that the cyclical bear market has begun. We've seen the first significant wave down in that bear market, and now we're bouncing, and it's a heck of a bounce. We've now rallied about 50%, 300 S&P points off that low at 2300. We're 2610, so that's what, halfway back to 2920 or so, which is pretty close to where the highs were. So, you know, we're coming up on that 50% Fib retrace. Will we get to 50%? Will we get to 61.8%? I don't know, but the question on my mind is, I don't think there's that much left to go before we run out of steam on what I'm convinced is a bear market rally. And the question then is, how do we start to line the dominoes up for what's going to happen next? I cannot think of a single person on earth that I would rather ask about this than Charlie McElligott. So let's stay tuned and see what he has to say in the feature interview.
All right, let's move on to the U.S. dollar because the dollar index traded temporarily below 95 and it kind of tapped down there a few times below, but never really broke below 95 and now has turned around and staged an impressive rally. Is the rout over? Are you bullish the dollar still?
You know, I think so, but I'm kind of leaving room. We're not out of the woods yet. We're getting so many conflicting messages, China trade, Fed tightening, dovish pivot, not dovish pivot. You know, it seems to just change every few minutes. I think that if I had to predict something, it would be more volatility and uncertainty, but I think it ultimately gets resolved higher. I won't be surprised, though, if we dip down to 94 before we go higher. If that happens, I'd look at it as a buying opportunity.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil because we've been talking about, you know, how far this rally could go. And you shared with us that you didn't think it was going all the way back to 80. But, you know, we were talking about this overhead resistance near this 51, 52. What comes next here? Do you think oil still has a little more room to go?
Well, first of all, we don't have any inventory data because we're recording the show early this week and inventory comes out tomorrow as we're speaking on Tuesday afternoon. Saudi Arabia continues to jawbone the market and we've seen, looked like oil got a little bit of a boost today from President Trump talking about possible sanctions on Venezuela. I sincerely doubt that that will actually happen, but, you know, a little bit of rhetoric can spike the market a little bit. I still think that we are nearing the top of a consolidation range, and I wouldn't be surprised if we bounce around between 45 and 55, or maybe it's 42 and 52. I'm not sure. But, you know, low 40s to low 50s on WTI, a few dollars higher on Brent. I'm guessing that's where the consolidation range is going to be. I'll be very surprised if we move above 60 on WTI. Below 40 is entirely possible, especially if we get a big inventory build and economic news in the same week. But right now, my base case is kind of a trading range here between low 40s and low 50s, and we're certainly at the high end of that range now.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because we saw a pretty impressive push in gold up towards the 1300 level round number. And since then, that's clearly been at least an intermediate kind of, no, at least a short-term resistance level. What's your take? Is gold going to have the gusto to make this break?
I don't think so. But as I said last week, you know, my favorite case is gold tops out here and moves back lower as the dollar index eventually starts to recover. But as I also admitted last week, gold has been stronger than I expected in the last few weeks. We've seen it trading as more of a safety trade asset as opposed to an inverse dollar correlation trade. And it surprised me. So maybe I'll be surprised again. Certainly a daily close over 1300 and then staying there for several days, that would really force me to reevaluate my view. But right now, I'm leaning towards topping out here with this round number resistance at 1300 and maybe rolling over and heading back to the downside.
All right. Well, let's get on to the 10-year treasury yields, which are now hovering around this 270 level. What comes next here for in your mind?
Well, it's really interesting to see whether we go below 260 again or above 280 first. Charlie clearly has been the man for making the tactical calls on this, so I'm going to save most of it for the feature interview with Charlie McElligott. But my view is not a lot of conviction here. I think that a move that's below 260 or above 280 and sustained above or below those levels would be a technical signal. Until we get that, I think the market is trying to digest a lot of conflicting news, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see some more volatility in the middle of that range where we are right now.
All right. So this week's featured interview guest is Nomura's Charlie McElligott. Now, Eric, we wanted to start having the conversation as to why we chose the guest and why we're bringing him on. So, Eric, why Charlie?
Well, Patrick, ever since Charlie joined Nomura and started publishing this daily institutional letter, which you and I both receive and which is available to our qualified institutional listeners, he's just really had a fantastic track record. He called this Christmas massacre before it happened. In a lot of these big equity moves, he was publishing that morning. He's saying, look, when we get to this level, that's going to tip our CTA model. Look for the selling to accelerate as soon as the S&P touches this number. And those predictions were just spot on. They came true. It was really just phenomenal how accurate he has been. And really what's impressed me is every time I read his letter, it's just full of insight and it's thoughtful. And he just seems like one of the brightest minds in the industry right now. And I'm really glad that we're able to get him on the program. So needless to say, he called the move down Christmas. He immediately called for a relief rally to begin. That was exactly right to go long there on that Christmas bottom. And he was on the right side of that call. Let's see what he says in this interview about how much further this market has to run.
You know, Eric, I personally love having Charlie on the show because we have no shortage of people come on and give us a fundamental story, a macro fundamental driver of what's going to cause things. But bridging the macro fundamentals with the liquidity and using quantitative analysis to understand how money flows and moves between asset classes is so important. And there's a lack of people doing it, or at least that are we can bring on to the show. And this is why it's such a treat to have Charlie come on. So I'm looking forward to it. Eric's interview with Charlie McElligott is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Charlie McElligott, the man who both called the Christmas massacre event and was very outspoken in telling people that his CTA model was expecting a dramatic increase in the pace of selling if certain levels were hit, which they were, and then right afterwards called for there to be a relief rally, which is exactly what's happened. So, Charlie, congratulations. You are knocking it out of the park with the calls you've been making lately. I want to to start with China because that's what's on everybody's mind with the trade talks and so forth. Give us the update. And also, we do have a chart deck from you. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email or next to Charlie's picture on our homepage if you're not yet registered. Why don't we jump into your chart book and talk about China, what is driving the situation, and how China is going to play into market action as this whole trade talk thing gets resolved in the next several weeks or months.
Sure, guys. So appreciate the opportunity to be on again and speak with you. I had a great time last time and expanded some of the folks that I interact with. So thank you for that. You know, I think as we look to kind of base this conversation out of the impulse that's originating out of China, and last time we spoke, we did touch on that idea of the Chinese credit impulse. That credit impulse, of course, with regards to the government's pushing on a string of credit out through social financing, through new loan growth, through efforts to stimulate money supply. That has been kind of the past is prologue playbook for Chinese responses to liquidity tightening and economic slowdown. I think what the update is since maybe we last spoke with regards to the continued degradation of the Chinese economy here has been, you know, it's been twofold, frankly. You're dealing with a situation where, you know, policies have been very focused on preventing financial crisis and a credit freeze. Other policies, they're trying to support growth, but not enough to offset some of the negatives that are developing. And it's both a domestic demand issue, and from, you know, the folks that we have kind of boots on the ground economic contact with there, I don't think a lot of folks in the West understand the incredible cynicism, skepticism, pessimism view from the ground within China. I think that also too, kind of risk markets, global markets have been anticipating a more holistic boom pow response from Chinese authorities, from the policy setters, from the PBOC, from the Ministry of Finance, that more than what the Chinese authorities are able to provide, meaning there is no kind of short-term QE solution, rate cut solution that would give the market what it wants. Instead, it's been these very piecemeal attempts, right? I think we've had now four triple R cuts since last January. We've had a number of value-added tax cuts, some corporate income tax cuts. The fact of the matter is, and certainly mandating putting more pressure on local authorities and banks to, you know, stimulate that loan growth, that credit impulse, they are now in a really tricky part of their process right now. And I think, generally speaking, it was consensus. Folks understood that when you pile on the trade war, right, and the impact that that's having, that the tariffs are having on Chinese trade, that you're in a situation where because of the tariffs implementation, there was this potential relief by pulling forward much of the ordering from clients of Chinese counterpart corporations. And you did see that to a certain extent, very, very limited extent in some of the, you know, the now Q4 monthly data that's coming out. I think what's happened in the last couple of days is that you actually saw in the Chinese trade data yesterday, export growth was down 4.4% year over year, which is a negative read on industrial production, employment, on GDP. And then import growth was down 7.6% year over year, which, you know, also speaks to this further domestic demand slowdown. It's highlighting that we've already hit the end of that tariff front-loading effect. So you're really now dealing in the market, and we're going to talk on this very tactical, very positioning-driven risk rally that I've been making the case for since mid-December. But I think now you're at that point in the market where there is a lot of discomfort in kind of owning this rally because you're seeing this negative global growth impulse out of China really get picked up in the global data. And our view, our in-house view, Ting Lu, our Chinese economist, has been way more aggressively negative than the rest of the market and continues to be, is that it's only going to get worse in Q1 and Q2, especially now that that tariff front-loading effect is gone. And I think we kind of print the absolute lows in Q1 Q1 into Q2 2019, which then forces the, you know, as I referenced earlier, that escalation of Chinese stimulus responses, of Chinese easing, that you can then begin to see some of the lagging impact of the fiscal stimulus, of the easing, to actually then start to see the global economic relief begin to register.
Now, I want to ask a qualifying question. When you say that it gets worse into Q1, I'm assuming we're talking about the Chinese economic data getting worse, but I could imagine that translating to more accommodative policy and potentially U.S. markets maybe rallying as the U.S. Fed gets a little more accommodative because of what they're afraid of. So are we necessarily expecting global markets to be worse, or you just mean the Chinese economic data gets worse in Q1?
No, it's the right question to ask. It's a critical clarification. So we're absolutely speaking with the Chinese economic data, which in turn is having this dragging effect globally, right? We saw the German GDP print yesterday confirm the slowdown fears. It's, of course, a known thing, right? You know, Germany is the world's third largest exporter, the largest economy in Europe. It's very much representative of the flu that has originated out of China. I think what this next wave is with regards to that Q1, Q2 behavior in China is that you're now going to see a situation where instead of this kind of growth deterioration or growth deceleration, it's now going to become, which has been due to this deleveraging campaign they began 2 years ago, so it's self-inflicted, you're now going to see the credit crunch in H1. You know, that's really where I think you're going to start seeing the narrowing impact and the smaller response that their economy is getting from these various piecemealed stimulus and easing efforts. They're smaller, they're more narrow, they're less effective than past policy stimulus. Now you're going to see the payback for the front loading of exports. You're going to see probably now the property market corrections, certainly in the lower tier cities is our house view, and probably more defaults and widening of credit spreads in China. That ultimately, which you're highlighting specifically here, Eric, that is things getting worse to force that more aggressive, much more aggressive policy response from Chinese authorities that ultimately puts us back on track for a kind of a global economic pivot off of these, you know, H1 19 lows is what we are anticipating.
Charlie, let's move on now to the bigger picture of where we are in the market. You've talked a lot about being late cycle, and you've described a lot of things just impeccably well. The way I assimilate all of this is it feels to me like the top is probably in for this equity market, and we're into a bear market. The first wave is over, and we're into that first significant bear market rally. First question is that view consistent with your view? And of course, the much bigger question is, if it is, how much further does that bear market rally have to go before it's done? When do you start to look at changing direction? And something I've noticed that you are exceptionally good at is lining up the dominoes of what are the events that need to happen in order for the market to get to a certain resolution. So how do you see this whole thing unfolding, and how am I doing in terms of the view that I've assimilated from some of the things you've said in the past?
You know, when I was on the last time, I was really speaking to my two-speed year thesis for 2018, and specifically highlighting that we had transitioned into this new macro regime from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, and the impact that QT was going to have on financial conditions tightening from there. Financial conditions tightening bleeds into the real economy. The behavior that we began to see and were highlighting on our last visit, specifically within the housing sector, the automobile sector, regional banks, super cyclicals like semiconductors, chemicals, all of that price action that truly went remarkably recessionary. If you look at kind of the Q4, certainly the December price action, markets, and this time, may I add, it was equity markets, not fixed income, that priced in this growth scare and priced in ahead of other markets. You know, oftentimes people take knocks on equities for being more the confirming agent instead of the leader. Equities were way ahead on this overall downshift message. And my whole message has been that we are pushing into the end of the cycle and we've tightened ourselves into a slowdown. That tightening ourselves into a slowdown was kind of the key delta as far as the market behavior in Q4 as well. There was a period in Q3, let's say September, where we made, again, new local highs and S&P highs, right? And people thought we'd escaped, you know, the equity volatility regime shift that was experienced after the vol event in February of last year. But that wasn't the case. And part of that thesis where I had a big October financial conditions tightening tantrum call was that October was going to see a significant month of balance sheet inflection. And balance sheet inflection meaning two very large Fed SOMA runoffs, right? So the SOMA account, the securities account at the Fed, where there was going to be maturation of large notional U.S. Treasuries and maturation of large notional mortgage-backed securities. And George Goncalves, our rate strategist, was almost 7 months ahead of anybody else in the street when we worked with him on this, as far as highlighting last July the quantitative fact that is large balance sheet runoffs within the Fed, particularly in mortgage-backed securities, see a corresponding move lower in risk assets, in particular S&P. So with that in mind, the fact that we had these two massive runoff days, let's say, because we've grouped these on a weekly basis in October with the Fed's balance sheet, corresponded with the ECB's own tapering from $30 billion of purchases down to $15 billion of purchases, as well as at the same time, the Bank of Japan was conducting stealth tapering of their own bond buying operations. You ended up having this very volatile October trade. Momentum unwinds across the equities, long, short, market neutral space, caused huge performance decay. And what we did, and I digress, going back to the original point, was that we transitioned from that very September idea that we were growing faster than we were tightening to this glass half empty view that we had tightened ourselves into a slowdown. That match was lit by Jerome Powell on October 3rd with his now infamous misstatement with regards to the, you know, far from neutral commentary, which implied to the market that the Fed was setting us on a course for Fed policy error and that we were indeed going to tighten until something broke. What has since transpired, of course, is a reversal. And that's the way that markets work in this day and age. The reaction function, unfortunately for the Fed, is kind of the market tail wagging the dog. So instead of Fed policy dictating asset behavior, markets now dictate Fed policy behavior. So as we in December kind of hit the peak panic button, and a lot of that was due to year-end timing, a lot of that was due to multi-year highs in gross notional exposure within the leveraged hedge fund community needing to be unwound over the course of 2018, you saw such terrible performance. You saw such leverage removal precipitously in Q4 that we just got that final kind of purge of positioning. It was really just a value at risk, a VAR, a risk management event, that final impulse. When markets got that bad, however, it forced the policymakers, specifically within the Fed, as well as this also happening within China at the same time, it forced them to take more action, right? So those are two critical sequences that needed to shift us into this kind of current stance, which is this much more sympathetic, much more constructive kind of qualitative macro backdrop. And the third was that, you know, knowing that there was going to be these ongoing US-China trade negotiation talks in a 90-day window, which actually wasn't 90 days. It was actually after the G20. It was actually more like 60 days plus, you know, a week. That actually made us realize that there was going to be increased likelihood of positive leakage, because both Presidents Trump and Xi needed market relief for their own purposes. And that has allowed this very slashed positioning, slashed exposure, max short CTA behavior as you know, certainly the long equities trade lost momentum and pivoted max short. We've seen an environment where with risk parity funds, our internal models have shown them positioning for a slow growth, slow inflation backdrop, which is adding massive fixed income, adding to their gold positions, cutting equities, cutting credit, cutting commodities like risk commodities as well. And you've effectively had this backdrop where people have purged their risk exposure right into the policy inflection. And that's more or less, without getting into the systematic flows, that's more or less what set the table for where we are now at this current risk rally.
Now, let me make sure I'm not missing something, because what I'm hearing is you've got the Fed threatening at one point last fall to tighten until something breaks and people are panicking. And you've got these big Fed balance sheet roll-offs that are equivalent to a hike in many respects. And a lot of people have proven the numbers behind that. Now what we seem to have is the Fed has blinked and is saying, okay, the market is no longer pricing lots of hikes in 2019. We're down to either no hikes or even some people are talking about cuts. Everybody's breathing this huge sigh of relief. Okay, it's better now. Well, wait a minute. The Fed still has a whole bunch of balance sheet roll-offs in 2019. And Powell's been pretty darn adamant saying that they're sticking with that. So am I missing something, or are there really effectively stealth hikes in the form of balance sheet roll-offs that maybe the market hasn't fully priced in yet?
QT is unequivocally a financial conditions tightener. It saps dollar liquidity, and dollar liquidity is the reason that we've had contracting dollar liquidity is the reason that we've had rolling volatility events for the last year plus. So yes, unequivocally, the balance sheet tightening, the balance sheet runoff is an ongoing negative risk asset impulse. It's an ongoing financial conditions tightener. What the Fed did from a very forward guidance central bank speak perspective, you know, think about Mario Draghi and whatever it takes, you know, that commentary single-handedly turned for a multi-year period the European crisis on its head without spending one penny of euros on their emergency bond buying program. In this sense, what the Fed did was that the Fed hasn't just capitulated with this now kind of code speak for patience, which is equivalent to the Fed pause thesis, which, you know, I think last summer when I was bringing up the concept of a Fed pause, 90% of the fixed income world was laughing at me saying, no way, this thing is preset, autopilot, lights out. And my point was that the markets wouldn't allow it to get to that point, because the impact is too massive, the perceived impact is too massive. What they also did too was open up the possibility of decreasing or outright cessation of the balance sheet unwind over the last, you know, week and a half since this most recent Fed meeting. And what that has done has thrown a lifeline to folks that are concerned about this. That said, you've got it exactly right. In the meantime, it's still going on at the same clip. And that is part of my longer term structural thesis, why if you are an investor, if you're an owner, and you're looking at this end of cycle trade, and remember, the catalyst for a U.S. slowdown, or a, you know, at a minimum, or a recession, whether it's late 2019, if you're on the bearish side, or a 2020 story, which I think would put you in the consensus, these are very much tangible and frankly accelerating, right? So you have a still ongoing and lagging negative impact of Fed tightening, right? So real yields, yes, have come off significantly, but they remain at multi-year highs, while inflation break-evens and inflation expectations and break-evens have dropped to multi-year lows. You have the fading U.S. fiscal stimulus, right? The tax cut impact continues to diminish in half-life. You have the dragging wealth effect of what happened last year with all assets in investor portfolios and people's retirement accounts and things that make them feel like they have paper wealth, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge what a large part of quantitative easing was, and that was to create a wealth effect. That was to create, you know, a sense of wealth that will help stimulate discretionary spending. And that just took a wallop to the face. And then I think kind of the final reality, which is incredibly cyclical, of course, is the corporate deleveraging, which inherently means lower CapEx. I referenced a bunch of times, I think it came out late November, potentially early December, but either way, the Fuqua School, the business school down at Duke, releases a corporate CFO survey on expectations, on business environment expectations. And particularly, they ask a number of questions with regards to you know, recession timing, CapEx spending environment, things like that. And nearly 50%, I believe it was 48% off the top of my head, saw recession hitting in calendar 2019. By 2020, that number went up to north of 90%. So the point being that these are the people that are, you know, making, these are the C-suite of corporate America, Fortune 500, you know, S&P 500 type companies that have this kind of late days, late cycle view. What are you going to do with your cash, right? Are you going to go out and, you know, create organic growth, or are you going to batten down the hatches? Are you going to hike compensation, or are you going to, you know, sit tight on your cash stockpile and buy back shares? You know, that speaks very pessimistically, and that's a way that you can get kind of a tracking, you know, a current tracking, say 2.7% GDP, 0.5 here and a 0.3 there and a 1% here, all of a sudden you could get to a recession, a negative GDP growth type of a number in the coming quarters. So that is very real. And I think that the market was pricing that type of environment in, pulling forward, understandably. Everybody sees the strength of the consumer. Everybody sees the strength in labor markets, as per the most recent non-farm payroll, of course, with a very strong average hourly earnings print. But I think at the end of the day, equities markets know that the data is lagging and that the markets are real time. And that's why the Fed didn't just back away and transition to a coordinated pause message, which again was reiterated today from multiple Fed speakers, taking a couple quarters off. My view, June is the earliest they would possibly look at a Fed hike again. And frankly, the rates market continues to call that bluff, pricing in the end of the Fed cycle still to this point, and almost a full cut again in 2020. That's what forced the Fed to not just go with the pause story, but I think also too the break glass scenario, which would be them decreasing or even outright stopping the balance sheet unwind. In the meantime, it's continuing until markets get sloppy again.
Let's bring the dollar into this discussion about the Fed balance sheet roll-off, because I think most people are kind of hugging the view that, okay, look, there's been a big run-up in the dollar, but that was to be expected. The Fed was hiking, and of course, it's all about interest rate differentials. That's what drives everything. Now that the Fed is pausing, then the dollar's got to go the other direction. But from what you're saying, really, the balance sheet roll-offs are dollar liquidity exacerbating. So are balance sheet roll-offs just as dollar bullish as rate hikes are?
I think in the scheme of things, at a minimum, equally important. And if you're talking about, I think the idea is this, people understand after the crisis, or, you know, kind of into that crisis period and thereafter, how much dollar-denominated debt around the world, you know, exploded multiple trillions, you know, since in the post-crisis environment. So between that mix of rate hikes, between that mix of quantitative tightening, which is pulling dollars out of the system, and then you add in a third point, so not just the hikes and the quantitative tightening, but the massive uptick 2 years in a row of year over year doubling of expectations for treasury issuance to deficit fund. You're just hoovering dollars that used to be there for anything in the world, whether it was risky assets, whether it was for emerging markets credits, whether it was for, you know, industrial metals. These were all excesses of the QE regime that are now being reversed. And look, you know, I think part of this, and this is not something that I can quantify or point to, but I think part of the Fed's desire to talk dovishly with regards to willingness to touch, to modify, or to even halt QT while in the background continuing on with it, and I said it's their break glass option, is that they know that in the case of the inevitable next recession or next crisis, that it is a very, very high likelihood that they're going to have to add to the balance sheet again. I'm telling you right now, whether it's conversations with, you know, massive institutional investors or macro traders on a desk, they will all tell you to their face that if we do hit that panic button and we do, you know, hit the slowdown into recession, Fed cuts alone don't mean squat to markets. You don't care about a 25 bips cut when we've still barely gotten off the zero bound, right? What matters are the purchases of assets, are the purchases of treasuries, or the perpetual flattening of curves to ease financial conditions, or the purchases of mortgage-backed securities to help clear, you know, which is a legacy construct of the prior crisis, but to help with those, you know, that massively economic multiplier amplifier that is the housing industry in our country. And ultimately, I think in the next crisis, we turn to look like the BOJ, and Janet Yellen has already outlined this years ago, that we could, in fact, be buying ETFs. And I think that's just an inevitability of where we're going. And that's a, you know, that's a point for the future. But it is clear to me that part of the reason they are so committed to maintaining this balance sheet runoff, say, over the next year to year and a half, is because they know they need to create room before they start adding again.
Charlie, I want to move on to your CTA model, which has become extremely popular with our listeners. But before we even get into the slides that you have starting on page 9 of the deck, I wonder if you could just explain the big picture of how this model works, what it predicts, and why the numbers that you use for thresholds are kind of moving targets. We had you on last time. You mentioned gold really had a magic number around 1245, which it was on the day that we spoke. 3 or 4 weeks later, we had people on Twitter saying, hey, we hit the number. Charlie said the magic number is 1245. What's going to happen next? And of course, at that point, your number in your daily note was up to 1298 or something. Why is it a moving target? And what do we actually learn from this CTA model? How does it work?
Sure. So there's a number of proprietary signals of momentum that are everything from kind of traditional classic technical measures, as well as because of the vol component to any sort of trend strategy, any sort of strategy that is levering onto lower realized volatility assets, levering more, there's a negative convexity. And because of that, realized volatility are critical to sizing and scaling the long or the short position, meaning the size of the overall position within this large portfolio of you know 58 cross asset futures contracts that our model replicates. So what's important to note, and to your point, our QIS team creates these, we have these outputs, and what is important to note here is a number of things. CTAs in general, trend models in general, are shorter term in nature. And certainly CTAs got a ton of press last year because they got, you know, lit on fire, in all honesty. And that's the purest representation that last year was the anti-trend, right? You had this huge macro regime shift. You had rolling volatility events. You had the unwind of systemic leverage accumulated over the 10-year post-crisis period in quantitative easing, and that forced a lot of positioning overshoots, positioning asymmetries, leverage blowouts, VAR events, that you had this incredible chop, you know, intraday, across the days, you know, different vibes from one day to another, from 1 week to another, month over month, quarter over quarter, complete reversals. So that's why CTA models did so poorly last year. The fact of the matter remains that these are short-term in nature, and especially in a market where fundamentals tend to get pitched, and people are trying to get their legs on what is the new macro regime and what is the policy backdrop? Where is growth going with these rapid, you know, deceleration in global data? These types of strategies become that much more important in becoming the price setters because, one, there still is a massive amount of assets in them, and it's one of the most heavily leveraged strategies on top of that. And with that, same confusion that I spoke to with regards to kind of the fundamental backdrop and where we are in the cycle and all these questions on policy and all these geopolitical issues that are still floating out notwithstanding as well, you're in a situation where the fundamental discretionary active folks of the world are an even smaller part of the overall kind of liquidity profile. So the impact of these systematic strategies, whether it's a CTA trend model or whether it's risk parity or whether it's a target volatility variable annuity fund, all of these different strategies have an outsized impact because the liquidity deteriorates due to this kind of tightening liquidity environment the reduction of leverage in the environment, they're having an outsized impact. So that's why the CTA model, I think, received so much notoriety and attention last year. And it's a really good model. You know, this thing back tests to the index on a 3-year look back within 50 bips of the actual index. I mean, this thing has been engineered brilliantly by our QIS team. So with that said, you're dealing with a 2-week window. You're dealing with a 1-month window, a 3-month window, a 6-month window, and a 12-month window. And especially looking at the 2018 landscape, which was, say, within equities, for instance, up 2% one day, down 1.5% the next day, down 2% the next day, and up 2.5% the next day after that, it's very important to understand which days are rolling into and rolling out of these various look-back windows across the different tenor models. So, for instance, we might touch on this, you know, later in the call, but day over day in our S&P model, for instance, right, in our S&P 500 model, which per my call back in early December that we were going to see this major sell impulse when our models went almost consensually max short positioning across global equities futures, we've been sitting near this threshold to actually cover some of that short over the course of the rally over the last 2 weeks, and which was a large part of my base case for this tactical rally call that I started making in December. And to capture this point with regards to the movement of the trigger levels, yesterday was was still 100% max short in the S&P, and the trigger level to cover down to just 82% short, so reduce roughly 20% of the scale of the outstanding notional short in S&P, was sitting at 25.95 in S&P futures. So a close above that level, we would have triggered the cover. You know, it would have been somewhere around $9.2 billion to cover. We closed right below that, but then coming in today and rerunning the model, what happened was that you lost a particularly volatile day in the 1-month window. So basically, December 14th rolled out a sample. What that December 14th day rolling out a sample did to our trigger level was it dropped the S&P covering level down a full 50 handles to 25.45. And that speaks to the movement. These are not static data points held constant in time. This is a daily reset based on the trailing realized volatility plus the price behavior. And with that drop, we were preordained basically today, X the absence of a major risk sell-off or some sort of a tape bomb and a noisy Brexit vote, which people have just completely tuned out, was not going to be that catalyst. We closed the day, currently I see futures at 26.06, nearly 60 handles above that deleveraging level. And in fact, our S&P model estimates that there was $9.2 billion of S&P covering to reduce that short. So that speaks to how these things are organic, how they're evolving, how they're constantly moving. And it's based off of the past performance windows across the 2-week, 1-month, 3-month, 6-month, and 12-month, as well as not just the price behavior, but the volatility, the realized volatility profile therein. Because again, these strategies need a trend. They will load more size, load more leverage onto something that is trending and creating positive P&L, which are why you get these brutal, unemotional reversals too. That's the beauty of these strategies. They'll go from a max short, cover it to a long, and flip max long before you can blink. And that's why they are first movers. And that's why they're so important right now as far as giving me those incremental short-term directional leans that we've used to make a bunch of good calls in the last year.
Tell us a little bit more about the timing of these signals, because when you first described it to me on your last interview, I thought that what you were saying was this is effectively if you see a daily close past this number, that's going to cause the algorithmic trading systems the next day to start doing their buying or their selling. But there have been a couple of occasions where in your daily note you said, okay, folks, if we get to X level during the day and it goes past that, it's going to accelerate. Watch out. And you were just uncanny accurate with those calls. So clearly, this does have an intraday action reflex function. How does that work? Who's making these decisions?
That's a great point. There are two things there. We make assumptions as to how our strategy is set up to act, and that is off of a closing level. We are making assumptions based on the entirety of a universe that very well may trade intraday, let alone have different signals and different levels, different inputs create different outputs. So for sure, there are certain strategies that I'm sure, you know, hit a threshold and boom, they're going long. Boom, they're covering. Boom, they're pressing their shorts. I think the other component, though, that really captures what you're speaking to is the self-fulfilling nature of what these models have become. And that absence of a real fundamental view, especially which is a kind of a chicken or the egg impact of the performance environment, sees discretionary managers, active traders, fundamental folks increasingly at the mercy of these levels. And I am absolutely 100% certain that folks then build these levels into their psychology and into their framework. So not only are there folks that will try to front run these levels for day trades, I know that for a fact. I talk with people that do it and they feel like it helps their cause, you know, just quick in and out of trades. But it also too, these things tend to self-fulfill, where clearly over the course of the last 2 weeks, my identification that this max short positioning was now established and now was a likely catalyst for a squeeze, especially once you got that Fed reversal towards easing of policy and talking about willingness to touch balance sheet, the escalation of China policy easing and capitulation there, and then this kind of this resolution, progress, positive leak stuff out of China trade negotiations. All of that has created the backdrop by which you had this very much grabby behavior from people that frankly don't have, certainly within the equities complex, for instance, don't have the exposure on. Their beta to the S&P is low. They've taken their grosses down. They've taken their nets down. They're high in cash. They've taken their portfolio beta down and are very defensive in posture, and they're missing this rally. Now people know that these numbers are out there. They get itchy trigger fingers, and they think that the systematic strategies are going to be buying ahead of them. They buy ahead of the systematic strategies. So there's this feedback loop impact as well, Eric. And I think that is, I know, frankly, that that's also part of the calculus.
Okay, Charlie, with that backdrop in place, let's go ahead and dive in at page 9 in your deck to the CTA model positioning estimates that you're showing now. What is this graph showing us? And why don't you walk us through the next couple of charts in the deck here?
Sure. So, I think really what I wanted to grab there was not simply just regards to kind of this, you know, this capture of kind of general risk sentiment, but also to capture this idea that the trend has been very much about a slowdown posture. And of course, you know, a CTA model is not worrying about a macro output per se, right? There might be macro overlays unequivocally. There could be humans that are kind of tilting the behavior to some extent with regards to exposures. But generally speaking, that's against the point of this, of the quantitative strategy. What this is capturing, though, against a backdrop of some other things that I'll bring up, is that you've really seen markets, whether it's these systematic trend models or later risk parity or discretionary equity long short, pivot into a very risk off stance, which is part of, a huge part of the reason that, you know, we find ourselves now 270 handles in the S&P off the lows made 2 weeks ago. What you're seeing particularly here, you know, that kind of top bucket, you see major markets, it just goes through some of the primary kind of risk asset and key cross asset securities that can give you a sense for this much more risk off positioning. You see the max short in S&P 500, in Euro stocks, in Nikkei, the two G10 FX crosses there, Euro dollar, Euro US dollar, and US dollar yen. Obviously, the dollar yen short, I think, you know, both of those expressions are very risk off there. Short dollar yen and short euro speak to that similar footing in the FX space. And then that middle bucket is looking at rates, so treasuries, 10-year treasuries, and you have a max long. Then you look at crude, Brent and WTI, as global growth, consumption, the global economic engine, are also max short. And then you look at gold, and this is, I believe, 2 days old, this snapshot, but gold at basically 50% 50% long position, you look back to the far right column versus a month ago, that was an incremental short. And you see, again, looking in that month prior, that far right column, 1 month in parentheses, you see the, generally speaking, the escalation of this kind of risk off positioning over the last month. That next bucket down goes just a little bit more granularity across the global equities bucket. And you see the extent, again, of the short positioning. A lot of max shorts, negative 100s in that today snapshot. However, again, as I highlighted, this was a snapshot, I believe, from Monday morning. You do see that Russell 2000 had begun covering. You see that FTSE 100, Hang Seng, ASX, and KOSPI had all covered from that max short position, which was a precursor that told us that we were getting the ball rolling, that this max short bearish positioning had overshot. And then the right side of the screen speaks to the fixed income side of the risk off positioning, where you recall, and for the almost the entirety of 2018, one of the most crowded trades on the board for sure was bearish fixed income, was bearish treasuries, bearish rates. It was based upon above trend growth, above trend inflation, the tailwinds of fiscal stimulus, of the Phillips curve, of labor impacting wage inflation, all of these very kind of globally cyclical bullish phenomenon, plus the reality of Fed Treasury issuance, where supply, there was going to be this supply shock due to the deficit spend realities that we touched on earlier, that it was just going to really lean on global fixed income. And by the end of the year, and this is always part of my thesis, and it goes back to that Chinese credit impulse slide, is that once you lose that credit impulse and commodities and inflation expectations and industrial metals and cyclicals versus defensives ratios, those all start coming off because you're unable to create the demand side into this tightening liquidity backdrop via Fed's QT, via China's deleveraging efforts, via, you know, later the ECB slowing their bond purchases and even the BOJ tapering their bond assets. What it ended up doing was create this very real slowdown in the back half of 2018 that got picked up in the very cyclical data, the very cyclical US data, as well as kind of global manufacturing data, right? I mean, I think you have the JP Morgan Global Manufacturing PMI index is down 9 of the last 10 months, right? Those types of things forced people into this much more defensive slowdown posture, which was the opposite of the bearish rates, bearish treasuries trade. It was instead max long treasuries, max long European government bonds, max long JGBs, and onward from there. That's slide 9 for you. What I touch on in slides 10 and 11 is something that I just mentioned earlier too, which is that risk parity, which is a systematic long only strategy, to be fair, but it's obviously become quite a talking point over the last 5 years. And it's critical, right? It's with regards to the assets deployed under the various iterations of the strategy around the street, the leverage deployed in many versions of the strategy. And the strategy is this: there is instead of allocating assets, what you're allocating is your volatility of your portfolio. So in a 60-40, you know, the kind of the old line of thinking in the Bridgewater marketing pitch is, you know, in a 60-40 equities bond allocation, 90% of your volatility is in the equities bucket. And what you should be doing instead is allocating your volatility. So to grossly oversimplify, because oftentimes there is a macro overlay that I will touch on, but to grossly oversimplify, you lever up the historically low volatility asset class. And that historically low volatility asset class is, of course, fixed income. Now, this is something I wrote about back in 2013 before the taper tantrum, is saying, well, wait a second. What if the historically low volatility asset class, treasuries or global fixed income, is a product of a 30-year bond bull market? And what if you actually have a rogue inflation print? Or what if the market, who is already at that time hooked on quantitative easing and hooked on bond purchases by central banks, picked up wind that the central banks were going to stop buying bonds, i.e. the taper tantrum, and boom, pow, you had those massive risk parity unwinds that due to, again, the assets under management, due to the leverage of the strategy, you had these huge cross-asset volatility blasts as these positions had to be deleveraged. Well, fast forward to slide 10, and what you see is actually a very, from a macro perspective, a very kind of slowdown, risk-off type of positioning here. And that is what a lot of, you know, a number of risk parity strategies will actually look at. They'll look at kind of a, if you look at a Punnett square of like four scenarios with higher growth, higher inflation in one, higher growth, lower inflation in one, and the permutations therein all the way around, what this current positioning estimate, as per our in-house model, shows is that you've sharply reduced the U.S. equities exposure. You're now just beginning to reduce the credit exposure. You know, so on a one-month basis, the largest single contract in our risk parity model sold is U.S. investment grade credit index. And then also, too, on page 11, you see the commodities, particularly the energy commodities, and the largest part being oil, crude, coming off sharply as well, near five-year type lows, all against a huge buildup of length of leverage, again, in traditional fixed income product. Particularly over the last month, we've seen that, you know, we've seen large buying in U.S. Treasuries, but enormous buying in JGBs. And JGBs, understandably, in light of 25 years of QE from BOJ, are pretty much the lowest volatility asset class out there in the kind of the global spectrum. So the idea being, they are very much aligned with kind of my end of cycle view with regards to this downshift into a slow growth, slow inflation, low inflation environment. Those are the key points that I wanted to bring up on pages 10 and 11.
Charlie, I want to skip ahead in the interest of time to page 20 in the deck, because I want to revisit a topic we discussed in your last interview, which is where so many people fear a inversion or a flattening of the yield curve. You say we should actually fear the steepening of the curve. What do you mean by that? Why it seems counterintuitive to a lot of people. What do you mean by it? And maybe talk us through the charts to explain your point.
So my longtime message has been that the key here with regards to the hyperventilation on curve inversions, the inversion obviously precipitates the steepening of the curve. But what really matters is that the curve steepening side of the of kind of the where we are in the cycle indicator is telling us that I've used the term in a number of my pieces and maybe even on this, on our last call, is that the market has finally sniffed out the slowdown. We've figured out that policy tightening, the normalization have impacted the real economy, that the lagging impact of tightening is starting to bleed into financing and funding and the cost of capital, and it's causing behavioral shifts with corporate management, CapEx discussion that we had before, and then ultimately it's affecting the actual output in the real economy. So when I say that, you know, what matters most is actually the steepening as the kind of the cyclical risk off signal, that's exactly what we've seen over the last, the last number of U.S. recessions, is that you don't need to worry about trying to reverse engineer the timing of the inversion into when does the U.S. recession start, just because there is no historical kind of signal there. It's incredibly noisy. What does signal, because it's closer to the real event happening, is that when you get the steepening, that's the market picking up the slowdown and confirming the slowdown. So the slides on 20 show you the extent of the front end. So we're looking at Eurodollar spreads. And this shows you the extent by which the markets went pricing out the end of the Fed normalization cycle and pricing in the easing cycle. And at the peak of early January, before the Fed's pivot, basically, before the Jerome Powell and Richard Clarida double whammy messaging that they were that the markets had forced them to take a knee, we were at a point where we had priced in almost a full cut in the end of 2019. you know, earlier I spoke about, and there was times since July of last year that the euro dollar 2020 calendar spread was telling us that the Fed was on the margin looking to cut. That clearly escalated to a full cut over the course of the last couple of months. What was so amazing in that real panicky December and then pre-Powell period in January was that we pulled forward that Fed easing, that Fed cut from 2020 into end of 2019. And that just captures the accuracy, frankly, by which the equities markets began pricing in this real recession risk that, you know, we spoke about in those deeply cyclical sectors. So we have since moderated, right? The dovish Fed pivot has done enough right now to offset the policy error concerns. They're telling us they're going to be patient, meaning there's no pause probably for the next two. Well, let's say this, there's probably going to be a pause through at a minimum June. And that's why you've seen a modest steepening again in these curves, in these euro dollar short-term curves. What I think is pretty important though here is that on that next page, just to get a little perspective on page 21 of, you know, the more traditional US Treasury curves and just get a grasp of kind of where we have come on a larger look back since say like 2009 over the, you know, kind of post-crisis period. And you're looking at 5s 30s, you're looking at 2s 10s, you're looking at 2s 30s, and you get a sense for the incredible flattening that has occurred, which has been by design. That has been by design because it eases financial conditions. It eases financing costs for corporates to do things that could stimulate growth. That's what the Fed has been doing with their balance sheet purchases, with their reinvestment plans. That's what they've been trying to create. Now, the market is seeing the impact of the reversal of these policies, and we are just now beginning this very nascent steepening. So that top panel there on page 21, that's the 5s 30s curve. In July of last year, the 5s 30s curve traded down 19 basis points. And there, you know, that's when people were, amongst many of these other curves that had, you know, hit local lows at that time, kind of decade lows, people were really hyperventilating, getting very scared about the implications for what that's telling us as with regards to the recession. And since then, since July, 5s 30s has nearly tripled. There's another powerful steepening move today. I think 5s 30s closed at, you know, 54 bips. So it's chopped around a little bit. But what that's telling us is, again, this. The market has priced out further hikes in the front end and not just moved to a pause stance, but moved to a view where within the next 12 months, we're anticipating the beginning of the Fed easing cycle. And that is hyper, hyper, hyper critical because the shape of the yield curve impacts so many things across the asset spectrum. In particular, I've always focused on the impacts that this has within the equities space, things like cyclicals versus defensives, and certainly a real talking point that I'm going to be focusing on. I focused on my note today and in the months ahead, huge impact with regards to this value versus growth debate within the US equities space. But yes, the concern and the trigger and the more near-term tactical signal is the steepening of the curve, because that's telling us that the slowdown is here, the slowdown is real, and that typically at that point, even though the Fed can have some impact with regards to liquidity provision as far as softening the impact on the depth of the recession, a slowdown is an inevitability. And that's where, you know, we need to watch, because in prior examples, and that's what I go over in slides 22 and 23, you know, kind of a year before the ultimate risk-off events, you begin seeing the curve steepening, you know, the curve steepening begin. And sometimes it's less than a year. That's also important to note.
And I think it's a really critical point, because there's a lot of people, I've seen this just reading around on the internet, people saying, boy, you know, that curve inversion was really scaring us, but well, we got some relief. It looks like it was a false alarm. It's all getting better now. You're saying it's not getting better. We're getting to the point where the Fed is recognizing, or the market is recognizing, that the Fed will need to recognize the need to take action because the shit's about to hit the fan. Am I correct to interpret it that way?
Absolutely. And look, I'll say it. This is not there is still, and I referenced this earlier, the strength of the consumer, the strength of the labor section of the economy is no doubt maintaining and offsetting what's going on in housing, what's going on in manufacturing. But there are, you know, especially once you look at kind of the disinflationary impulse that we're seeing globally right now, there's a lot of worrying signals. And this is something that I think is very interesting. And I, you know, from a timing perspective that, you know, I've called kind of my confirmation of, quote, imminent Fed easing signal has been, and back to the Eurodollar curve, right? The Eurodollar 2s-6 spread. So that's the second Eurodollar contract spread to the sixth contract. And this spread is now inverted. It went, you know, almost negative 25 bips, I would say, in the last couple of weeks. It's currently negative 14 basis points. So with the Eurodollar curve, you're dealing with the very, very front end of the curve, not, you know, looking out in the tenor, the year tenors of Treasury curves. And what this shows is something very interesting. So we've done some work here that shows over the past five easing cycles, the Eurodollar 2-6 spread has inverted prior to each. So this thing's got a 5-for-5 track record over the last five. And it's inverted about 6.5 months on average before the first Fed cut. So if I look at this in a different way and kind of broaden out the sample size to look back at the last nine Eurodollar 2-6 inversions, and not including this current inversion because that would be number 10, but the past nine that we've had the post-trade period, a Fed easing cycle has followed in seven. And the average length has come, that easing cycle began 8.2 months after the inversion. So to me, this continues to corroborate that we are slowing, and that slowing, for reasons that I, you know, brought up before, the lagging impact of Fed tightening, the ongoing QT, the fading fiscal stimulus, the dragging wealth effect on consumers due to the recent market shocks, and then the cyclical reality of corporate deleveraging, which inherently means lower CapEx, which means from an economic amplification perspective, you're going to continue to see that contraction and shrinkage, and capital is going to be used for non-growthy things like buybacks. That's how we get that slowdown impulse. And I think we're getting there, and the Fed is trying to ease the things that they can ease. And that's the market volatility, and that's the tightening of credit spreads. But that ultimately, the slowing is what bleeds through, and the end of the cycle overrides all.
So as we assimilate all of these signals that we've talked about today, let's come back to the original question, which is, as we look at the S&P, it's very clear that we're in some kind of relief rally. I think it's a bear market rally that's not going to take us to new all-time highs. How do you interpret these various different signals to tell you when it is time to actually be short and to look for this market to turn back down in the other direction?
You know, as mentioned, in mid-December, after I saw this complete overshoot and purging of exposure and max short positioning and trend and capitulation into, you know, Fed easing, Fed cut being pulled into a 2019 event, coming from a very different place, a diametrically opposite place just 3 months prior, it created this opportunity for this tactical rally, and we've gone over those catalysts, and that is what we're seeing now. People are being forced back into the market as the systematic, unemotional, first mover quantitative strategies reduce their short exposure and cover. And obviously, we're going to keep getting this Fed dovishness, which eases the financial conditions tightening. It helps VIX settle back in and helps credit spreads normalize. It certainly helped crude bounce. Crude is critical because of its impact on inflation expectations, and inflation expectations are the most significant macro factor for everything from U.S. equities to U.S. rates. You're seeing the same thing with Chinese policy capitulation. All those pieces are in place. I think to me, the way that I'm envisioning this now is that, yes, we are beginning to reduce some of that underexposure driver of this tactical rally I've been calling for. The key here is this, and I've compared it to, we ran an analog on the desk that is just shockingly accurate thus far. And we are now, we just completed the 15th day of this analog. But the analog is looking at scenarios where the S&P sold off greater than 17.5% as a trigger in 67 days or fewer. The overall idea being prior scenarios where you had this just massive violent de-risking in a very short period of time. And the highest correlation, the highest R-square of this current trajectory versus one of those prior trigger dates in our sample set is actually October 2007 through October 2008. And the analog is tracking to just a shocking degree of accuracy thus far. And then those slides are not in this deck in particular, but I'm using that in my background as kind of a triangulation point against what I see as this slow forcing of positioning. So to really oversimplify the way that the analog is projecting where we go from here, we're 15 days in. We are almost identical with regards to this current positioning analog on where the performance should be on this rally. We, per the analog, peak out on Friday of this week. And from there, you would see then over the following almost 2 week period, a 5% decline. And I think that's important because it actually does fit a lot of the qualitative discussions that I have with clients, where so many folks, and myself included, because I believe the analog, anticipate a squeeze, you know, this little bit of a force in, and then they want to fade it for the retest. And that retest is going to be everything. You know, I said in a note, I believe, end of last week, that this next kind of week and a half, 2 week period is going to be so important because you're going to basically determine whether or not you squeeze in the people that have been waiting for the pullback in equities or whether or not they actually feel confidence that it doesn't realize, they begin to short it, they begin to press it, and it completely resets the environment that we're looking at. I personally feel like the timing is very interesting because you're now just beginning to see people get very nervous that are underexposed and the tape held and the tape came back today, that you're going to see this discretionary active fundamental investor adding back their exposure. And then you also have in the backdrop the earnings call. And earnings is a volatility suppressor. And earnings also is important because by February 6th, you'll be through 75% of the S&P 500's buyback blackout. And that's that next leg, which corresponds actually with the local low that our analog predicts, that you then see a resumption in that trade higher. And that would really correspond with the corporate buyback bid re-entering the market and being able to buy back their stock still at, you know, these much more attractive kind of valuations than what they were looking at a year ago. And that's when corporates like to be in there buying their stock, defending their stock and using their cash. So I think that you're going to get a kind of a local high in the next couple of days. And then you have basically 2 weeks to retest the low before you get that buyback resumption. And I think we probably start trading higher from there. After that point, then it comes down to just how bad the data gets, how bad China gets, how bad the rhetoric around you know, the structural issues with the Chinese trade negotiations go. You can't get much more dovish Fed speak unless things get worse, right? So I think we're going to be back in that chop thereafter. But I, you know, to summarize, near-term squeeze out in the next, say, 3 to 4 sessions to localize. The next 2 weeks thereafter, you get a, you know, say 5% pullback. And then that should correspond and put us on track for the return of the buyback, the corporate buyback bid, which should see markets begin to get pretty constructive again, especially if we get a really solid purge or really solid retest of some of those recent lows. That would be the perfect scenario for me to get a little bit more, you know, tactically constructive and play this from the long side again. I think right now this tactical rally is in the late stages before the next phase.
Charlie, these fantastic graphs and charts that we're looking at in this deck are representative of the content that you send out every single day to your institutional list, and that email is free for qualified institutional clients. Please tell us a little bit more, and I'll apologize to our retail audience. Charlie doesn't make the rules that he's regulated by. He would love to share it with you, but he can't. So who is eligible for this, and who do they need to contact in order to get on this fantastic distribution list?
Sure, I appreciate that, sir. The easiest route is to reach out to your Nomura Global Markets sales contact, whatever asset class, and we can put them in touch with the right people on our end. Typically, we do have a revenue threshold, and there are certain regulatory dynamics with regards to domiciles, which I can and cannot send into, but we can work all that out behind the scenes. The path of least resistance, as always, call your salesperson, and we can get the ball rolling to begin dialoguing.
Well, I cannot recommend your daily letter strongly enough to those listeners who qualify for it, so I strongly encourage you to act on that. Charlie, we really look forward to getting you back on the program again soon. You just give a fantastic interview. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Charlie. It almost immediately struck me when he was talking about the idea of when the Fed finally starts to cut rates. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I kind of got this idea where he's basically saying rate cuts will mean squat. And it's really about when will the central banks once again start asset purchases. And he was even talking about Japanese style asset purchases occurring here. And that really struck me because to me, this is inevitable in my mind that once the business cycle turns and the credit cycles turn and the liquidity disappears, going to have to inject that liquidity back into the system some way. It's going to be really interesting how it plays out. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, you know, Patrick, I have to agree strongly with you and disagree at the same time. I couldn't agree more with what you just said, which is we're going to get to a point where things get ugly in the markets. And the way that Fed officials feel is that they have to really get accommodative and start buying assets and so forth. The thing that I don't think market participants are discounting adequately is what happens when this yellow jacket movement in Europe comes across the pond. And we've got the general public saying, hell no, we're not going to bail Wall Street out again. We're not going to let it happen. If we're going to print money, damn it, then give it to the people. Don't give it to Wall Street. Let's not buy assets. Let's print money and, you know, give it as some kind of helicopter money handout. And I think that what's happened is the political left that would favor a helicopter money kind of solution, they've had time to fully educate themselves about what happened last time and what they'd like to see go different next time. And I think that what we're going to see is a huge political debate that surfaces over this. And I think it could get a lot worse for markets. So many people just assume the Fed's going to come riding to the rescue. What happens when the cavalry comes riding in and it meets a picket line of yellow vest type of characters who are saying, no, you're not going to rescue Wall Street again. Rescue us. We're starving. We're the ones who do the voting here. You're going to help us, not them. So I think that's a really big thing. In general, the other thing that really stood out to me in this interview was the discussion about the fact that Fed balance sheet roll-offs are just as constructive to the dollar index as rate hikes. I think so many people are making an erroneous assumption. They're saying, okay, it really seems like we're coming to a pause or the end of this rate hiking cycle. That's got to mean the dollar rally is over, because everybody knows what drives the dollar rally is those interest rate differentials. You've got to remember this liquidity squeeze problem. What does the Fed balance sheet roll-off mean? It means that billions and billions of dollars of money in U.S. dollars that get repaid to the Fed are not going back into the financial system because the Fed just rolled over that debt and decided to buy new bonds with it that are new issues. It means that they're shrinking their balance sheet, and that is a huge dollar liquidity squeeze. It is very, very bullish, the U.S. dollar long term. And I think that it's very, very possible, as we discussed in the market wrap, maybe we do get a dip to 94 or something, because there's a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion in this market. But I think eventually we move much higher on the dollar.
You know, what I wanted to touch on is the steepener and the yield curve. It was saved till the end of the interview, but to me, it was actually one of the most important parts of the interview by far. And we didn't get into the details of how the curve is currently shaping. But what's particularly interesting is there's been a considerable steepening at the farthest part of the curve. When you look at the 10s and 30s and the 5s and 30s, we've seen that it was in the summer of 2018, over 6 months ago, that we saw the spreads narrowed down to like 10 basis points. We are actually at like almost 1 year highs. It's not yet 1 year, but we're definitely close to 1 year highs on the spreads widening. We're like at 35 basis points on the 10s, 30s, and we're on the 5s, 30s, we're over 50 basis points widening. But what the interesting part here is the 2s, 10s, which is the one that most people watch, has not begun to steepen yet. So the entire steepening that we've seen is only on the farthest end of the curve. And what will be really interesting to see is, when do we see the steepener at the middle to the short end of the curve? And that is a lot about when the market starts to price in the potential rate cuts by the Fed, that bull steepener. And that is something that I think is, we should not take our eyes off. When that starts to happen, we should have Charlie back on the show for sure. What's your thinking on that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. We definitely need to get Charlie back. He really needs to become one of our frequent regular guests on the program. But I think another aspect of what you just said is, we need to remember that the move that we saw, you say, you know, we haven't really seen the steepening in the twos, tens. Well, of course, what's happened is there has been a huge, huge move on the twos. But the thing is, there's been just as big of a move on the tens. Why the move on the tens? It's the unwind of a big speculative short that turned out to be wrong, and everybody's getting squozen out of that trade. The thing is, the twos were not subject to that big speculation that was in the tens. So we haven't seen it yet, but I think it's still coming. And what may be happening with this bounce that we're seeing off of, what was it, 2.58 on the 10-year, and we're back up to 2.70 now, maybe the 10-year kind of went through a short squeeze all the way up to 2.58, just barely breaking through that 2.60 support level on the yield. And maybe what's going to happen now is the 10 bounces back, but we still see a bull steepening as a result of the 2-year yield starting to move down more rapidly. And that would happen in anticipation of Fed cuts and further accommodative policy, a pause in the rate hike cycle, or even a pivot all the way around to a rate cutting cycle. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see what the rest of 2019 brings. I think we're coming up on some really big market moves. I'm not smart enough to know exactly what's going to happen. I think Charlie's a lot better than I am at laying out the dominoes and talking about the sequencing of events that might play out. But it seems to me like some pretty big moves are in the cards. But speaking of big moves, Patrick, we've got to get packed up for our own move over to Vancouver to host Macro Voices Live this weekend. Anybody who wants to sign up last minute, you can still do so at macrovoices.com/live. And we'll see you on Saturday in Vancouver. We'll be back next week with our regular show format and another fantastic guest. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting the program, so please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. How could they not have time to listen to Charlie McElligott in this interview? And send them your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account if you haven't done so already at macrovoices.com. It only takes a minute. It's free. We're not going to spam you. What we will do is we'll send you the free research roundup email, which contains links to our featured interview content, as well as all the best content that we can find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Charlie's chart book that was referenced throughout the interview. There's an article from Jeffrey Snyder titled Insight Japan, as well as an interesting article about the next 10 years in emerging market stocks. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.